Even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
Martin Luther King Jr., on this day, 92 years ago, he was born. Good morning, I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work. I'm in for Leslie Roberts today. And Martin Luther King Jr., born in Atlanta, Georgia, the son of a Baptist minister, January 15th, 1929. He received a doctorate degree in theology and in 1955 helped organize the first major protest of the African American civil rights movement, the successful Montgomery bus boycott. And think where we are today. Think where we are today. And at the age of 35, Martin Luther King Jr. was the youngest man to have received the Nobel Peace Prize. When notified of his selection, he announced that he would turn over that prize money of $54,123 to the furtherance of the civil rights movement. And on the evening of April 4th, 1968, while standing on the balcony of his motel room in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was to lead a protest march in sympathy with striking garbage workers of that city, he was assassinated by a white supremacist. And think where we are today. You would think that the words white supremacy wouldn't be uttered anymore. And the leader of the P-Boys from right here in Ottawa, after we see an insurrection the other week on Capitol Hill. But we need to honor this man. And I had the opportunity to speak with one of his right-hand men. His name is Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley. And he was there for that speech, that I Have a Dream speech, that we all talk about today, that we all reference. And it's so interesting to see that a man who was on the side of a political spectrum, that people tend to say, I don't want to have anything to do with that, all sided and continue to side so many people with Martin Luther King Jr. Because he wasn't on the side of a spectrum. He was part of a group. He was part of a collective representing the people. And so I say to Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley, who helped Martin Luther King Jr., who was there for Martin Luther King Jr., I say to him, you knew Martin Luther King Jr. so well. For today, what would he want? And he said, to turn that I Have a Dream speech into action, because it should no longer be a dream. It should be action. And so today, I just wanted to say a happy birthday to Martin Luther King Jr. His memory is a blessing that should serve right now to help us overcome the very things that he was trying to overcome back before he was assassinated by a white supremacist on April 4th, 1968. Happy 92nd birthday, Martin Luther King Jr. So today on Ottawa at Work, we are expecting the Prime Minister to speak at 11:30. There's new modeling that sees an even more sobering future for COVID numbers. So we're going to bring you that as it happens. Also, I've got a question for you on 580 CFRA's Facebook page. There's been a controversial decision to move 2 million New Jersey residents to the front of the COVID-19 vaccination line, and this is causing a stir. Should smokers, because of health issues, take priorities for vaccinations? We're going to get into that with a bioethicist later on the show. But you tell me your thoughts. You could tweet me at Dahlia Kurtz, and you can join the conversation on 580 CFRA's Facebook page right now. And something else happening in our medical community that is something that is typical of battlefields, and now we see it getting to that point. Triage. This is part of what doctors already have to do, but there are now new steps involved in this. Will the patient survive this medical emergency? Will the patient survive the next 12 months? The protocol, entitled Prioritization for Access to Intensive Care in Context of Extreme Pandemic, is 63 pages and lays out the criteria that must be considered. And there's one man who's joining us now who is going to have to consider this criteria, and I can't imagine having to go through that. He is the medical director of critical care at Toronto's Michael Guerin Hospital. He's Dr. Michael Warner. This is a very difficult time. This happens on the battlefield all the time, but now our medical system has turned into a battlefield. You signed up to be a doctor, not to be on a battlefield. How are you dealing with this, Dr. Warner?
Well, just to be clear, the policy has not been implemented, nor is there a specific time frame when it will be implemented. We were asked on Wednesday to familiarize ourselves with the policy and how to kind of execute it at a local level. It is quite complicated and involves a number of steps. So that's what we were asked to do. Hopefully, we will never have to use this, but the fact that it's been circulated means that we at the very least have to be prepared to do so.
Well, today, ahead of the new modeling that we're going to hear about from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, that gives another sort of sobering, I guess you can say, to be kind, trajectory to the numbers for COVID-19. But as someone who, you're not just listening to this, but you're seeing this paper that you need to read and understand, what's this like for you? What type of emotions do you go through as someone who needs to be objective and scientific, but you are so taxed emotionally, I would imagine?
I mean, right now I'm reading about it in a subjective way because I don't actually have to use it yet. I think it'll be very different if I have a patient in front of me or patients in front of me where I have to deny them care in a situation where I would normally offer them care. I mean, that's the main difference. Like right now, physicians and ICU physicians have the ability to not offer life support to patients that we do not think will benefit from it. That's within the Healthcare Consent Act. What's different about this policy is that depending on the triage level that is dictated by the Ontario Critical Care Command Center, patients we would normally offer life support to would be denied that life support based on the likelihood that they would be alive 12 months from now. Or 12 months from their critical illness. And that type of time frame is not something that ICU physicians typically consider. You know, we're acute care physicians. We live in the here and now. Of course, we want to make sure that people will benefit from an intubation, for example, in the short term, or else we wouldn't offer it. But we don't try to kind of guesstimate whether the patient will be alive 12 months from now. And in the level one triage, any patient with a greater than 20% chance of being alive 12 months from now. At level three triage, they have to have a greater than 70% chance of being alive 12 months from now, which is a relatively high bar. So that part of it, I'm not trained for. I don't know how to do that. And that's why I think the command table has asked that we familiarize ourselves with this so we can start to work through what this might look like if we have to use it.
As we've been going through the stages of the pandemic and into the second wave, is this a surprise to you or is this something that you were sadly expecting?
No, this is not a surprise at all. I mean, this type of policy or versions of it were created for the first wave and the government has had them. And this is not the first version of this policy. This is the latest version of this policy. So triage, I mean, I've talked about this in the media even before this policy came out. Part of it is being prepared. The healthcare system has to be prepared. But if it wasn't a possibility, we wouldn't have this policy to consider. So, I mean, the numbers from the modeling that Dr. Brown presented last week are really, really scary. And, ICUs, not so much in Ottawa, although there's been a few more COVID ICU patients in Ottawa lately, but in the GTA, Hamilton, Niagara, Kitchener, Waterloo, London, Windsor, the hospitals are overflowing with COVID patients and we still have to provide non-COVID related care. The other thing that's important for your listeners to understand is this triage protocol, if we have to use it, applies to all patients, not just COVID patients, every single patient, whether it's a heart attack, a trauma, some other type of infection, which is why everyone has a vested interest in making sure that we never have to use this.
I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work having a conversation with Dr. Michael Warner right now. He is a medical director of critical care at Toronto's Michael Garron Hospital. I'm looking right now at the new modeling. The spread of COVID-19 continues to surge rapidly, and new national modeling released today shows Canada is on track to see up to 796,630 total COVID-19 cases and 19,630 deaths by January 24th. Have you seen this new modeling yet, Dr. Warner?
I got to be honest, I'm working right now, kind of with my one ear to my pager, so I haven't seen the latest data. I think that the most important endpoints for me, at least in the hospital, are hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and of course deaths. The number of cases is really difficult to predict. Of course, deaths are a finite outcome, but we have to understand that the number of patients in Ontario's hospitals with COVID-19 has increased every time they've done modeling. We're over 400 patients in Ontario's ICUs with COVID-19, and a significant percentage of the patients in hospital who aren't in the ICU will deteriorate after they're admitted and come to the ICU. And there's only so many other hospitals we can load share with. So, for example, having beds in Ottawa or Kingston, Sudbury, and Thunder Bay doesn't really help you if you're in the greater Toronto area, because there are only so many critical care transport teams to move patients, especially far distances. So that's the challenge. Everyone's cup will fill up eventually. Healthcare workers are tired, and we're still trying to make sure that patients who need non-COVID-related care get it, but that has been completely rationed at some hospitals and scaled back significantly at others.
If you could get a blank check for our healthcare system, would that be able to save us right now from this overwhelming magnitude that you have to deal with and potentially going into something like this triage, this new triage that might be implemented in the future?
Yeah, a blank check isn't going to create ICU nurses or doctors. We have actually lots of beds, but a bed without a trained person to take care of that patient isn't a bed we can use. If I had a blank check, I would pay for sick leave for our essential workers so they weren't forced to go to work while waiting for their COVID test to come back. I would make sure that there are adequate supports for people in the community so they don't have to infect their family. I would probably pay a pretty penny for vaccines so we would get more vaccines on the open market, because I think that's what will be necessary to save us. I would invest in those the least fortunate, because those are the ones who get nailed first by COVID.
Well, what you're going through and what you're dealing with right now, along with all of our other frontline workers, from the doctors to the cleaning staff, it's so much. And thank you so much for everything you're doing. I just want to know our last question for you, Dr. Warner. In a time that is so bleak, and we're going to hear about even worse modeling today, as someone with the knowledge of science, as someone with the understanding of science, what gives you hope right now to get you through?
It's a difficult question. I don't really have a long view on this, because we kind of have to look at what's right in front of us, because it keeps changing. I think the vaccines are great news. I really hope those who are vaccine hesitant get the information they need to convince them to make a choice that I think is safer for them, which is getting the vaccine. Of course, that's still a choice. That gives me hope, but we need 6 to 8 months, I think, before a significant number of Canadians are vaccinated to help us get through this. Healthcare workers will always be there for you. We just need to make sure there are enough of us to take care of all the patients who come our way.
Stay safe, and thank you so much for taking your time while you have an incredibly busy day with one ear to a pager right now.
All the best. Take care.
That's Dr. Michael Warner, and he is a medical director of critical care at Toronto's Michael Garron Hospital. Still ahead, we're going to get to a new milestone in long-term care. It's not a good milestone, but it's an important one for us to talk about so that maybe we can help it. And go ahead and weigh in on the question online. controversial decision to move 2 million New Jersey residents to the front of the COVID-19 vaccination line, causing a stir. Should smokers, due to health issues, take priority for vaccinations? I'm Dahlia. It's 10:19 minus 1, going up to 1 degree today. This is 580 CFRA. You got your savvy love. When you kiss me, I know
you don't get to. But I still want that. Yes, this is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
And a lovely Friday to you. I'm Dahlia, and still ahead, an alternative to police that cops can support, how trained civilians, not sworn police officers, are responding better to hundreds of 911 calls. But right now, a guest, I love having her on the show, but I don't love having her on the show because we have to do it for reasons that are tragic, quite honestly. And this is now 10 months of these conversations when it comes to long-term care. We have hit a new tragic milestone, and we are now at more than 3,000 deaths. What do we do now? 10 months of begging for help from the province. Well, joining us, we have the CEO of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, Doris Greenspoon. Doris, you send me messages regularly, and they keep getting worse. Where are we at right now? We can't hear Doris right now, so PJ, my guy on the controls, is going to work on seeing what we can do to get Doris. Doris, do you hear me? We don't have Doris right now, I guess, but we're going to work on that. But 3,000 plus deaths in long-term care.
So, Dahlia.
There she is. Hi,
sorry,
Doris.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened, but you're right. 2 days ago, we hit the tragic milestone of 3,000 deaths. As you know, we had 1,800 in the first wave. On this wave, as of today, we have 1,237. My prediction is that, tragically, we may end up the second wave worse than the first. The only saving grace that we will have is the vaccine. But the vaccine, while we are completing very soon the nursing homes in the Toronto area, the focus has been very much in Toronto. The vaccine, as we heard yesterday, for example, is being diverted even from other places like Niagara, and people are very upset there. So we need all the nursing homes vaccinated ASAP. And what we requested is not only the residents, also their essential care partners and their staff. So the focus has been on the residents, which is fantastic, on the healthcare staff, that is very good too, of course. Essential care partners, which is the person that you remember we fought to have the reunification of loved ones, and we got that, so that is very good. Those in some homes, they're being vaccinated, and in other homes, they're not. And it's because of vaccine accessibility and because, sadly, Dahlia, the vaccines went first. Well, they went to the hospitals, and the hospitals vaccinated first their staff. They thought that it will be difficult to transfer the Pfizer vaccine to the nursing homes, even though other countries like Israel, that we use as an example all the time as number one, we didn't follow their example, that they said from the beginning you can have this vaccine 5 hours, not in that low temperature. So they did it, we didn't. You know, it's the same situation as before. You hear the rallies of families. They're doing rallies, actually, of course, masks and all of that. But they're devastated because not 1 minute has been added of care. Not 1 minute. You remember we asked for the basic care guarantee. What we will get is 15 minutes more of care per resident next year.
Doris, what has changed since that bombshell military report that first surfaced months ago?
Truly, the only thing that has that has changed is that they are sending more people from hospitals to look at the infection control. However, hospitals are being now overwhelmed, so that will not work. What needs to change, Talia, is that we need to build nursing homes in the inside with the resources they need. We do not and cannot continue to make them dependent on the outside world of the Canadian force, of the hospital on the corner, of whoever else. They need their own resources to be able to care for people in the way that people, residents, need and deserve. Their families desperately are crying for it, and the staff that work there are devastated too. So we need to build them from inside, and we haven't succeeded to convince government. We have a promise, but the promise is post-election, as you know, by 2024-25.
Do you want the military and nursing homes to help right now?
Well, you know, I'm afraid to say that I may say yes, which I, you know, that we didn't support that because we said build the supports. But if government insists in not building the supports inside, then bring the military. We cannot have people devastated. We cannot. We cannot. And more important, even bring the vaccines right away to the nursing homes first, as the national guidelines say, nursing homes, residents in nursing home first. And in fact, the guidelines, the national guidelines, which we deviated from them, also speak about adults 70-year-old in other areas, not only in nursing homes, because there are other areas where they're very vulnerable, including their own homes, that they have been sick and they stay at home. And if you don't bring the vaccine to them, that will be a disaster too with a new strain.
Doris, thank you so much for taking your time to join us, constantly keeping me posted, constantly fighting for the people who don't have a voice right now to do it. And we will continue to do that this weekend on The Goods as well.
Thank you very much, Dahlia.
Doris Greenspoon, she's the CEO of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. New tragic milestone, more than 3,000 deaths right now in long-term care. Still ahead, we're going to get to that alternative to police that cops can support. And San Francisco, Portland, Oakland, Toronto may be looking at this too. Should Ottawa? We're going to get to that. And that ethical question, should smokers be moved to the front of the COVID-19 vaccination line and take priority? You could weigh in on Twitter and Facebook. A bioethicist will weigh in later. I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work, 10:30. Your news is next.
EFRA.
And a good happy Friday to you. I hope you find some happiness in it. I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work. It's 11:05, minus one, heading up to 1 degree today. There is a snowfall warning in effect. You're safe on the roads today if you're going anywhere. Still ahead, we are going to hear from the Prime Minister. He's expected to speak live at about 11:30 on the new modeling for COVID-19. Also, what happens when COVID never seems to go away? How are those long haulers dealing with it? What are they going through? And what might you expect if you have to endure that as well? But right now, New Jersey is defending a decision to give smokers vaccine access before many people in the general public. It is an unhealthy habit, but it is moving 2 million New Jersey residents to the front of the COVID-19 vaccination line. The decision is to include smokers for that shot over professions like teachers or people who interact with students and the public on a daily basis. What do you think? Should smokers, due to health issues, take priority? Well, joining us right now, we have a professor of bioethics and global health at the University of Toronto, Dr. Carrie Bowman. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning to you.
Oh, wow. You are the most chipper good morning I have received yet. And a laugh, too. This is historic.
Well, the sun is coming out where I am, and it is a Friday for whatever that's worth. So I'm feeling good.
We take whatever we could get these days, right? I mean, that's the thing. That's exactly it. You know, I have to say, you also gave me another good chuckle this morning before we even spoke, because I Googled you. I see this black and white picture of you online, which was the first Google image I found. And you look like my boss, Peter Angioni, except with a wig. You need to Google him because he might be your long-lost brother. Are you related?
I'm not, and it's an old picture. I've aged. I don't know which picture you saw. Not related at all. Not related at all.
All right. Well, if you were, I would have asked you to put in a good word for me. So, sir, what are your thoughts here? Because there are critics who are arguing that, hey, smokers are the ones putting themselves at risk. And while that's true, if a smoker catches COVID-19, well, now that's putting the community at risk, too.
Yeah, well, look, people are going to feel differently about this, but let's just take a good look at how this decision came to be and what the science would indicate. Smokers, as I think many of your listeners may realize already, don't do as well with COVID because they've got reduced lung capacity. So, you know, if you look at this from a purely scientific point of view, and you're rolling out vaccines and you're saying, okay, who in our community, who in our world is most vulnerable? Smokers are up there. If they get it, they're more likely to run into serious trouble, potentially ending up in critical care beds. And the United States, as well as Canada, those are increasingly at a premium, as we know. Now, the other thing with smoking, you know, by modern views of 2021, smoking's considered an addiction, right? It used to be a habit. It used to be all those things. That's gone. People consider smoking an addiction now. So, looking at that and looking at this purely through the lens of medical priorities, that's how the decision was made. Now, what some people would say is this is insane. This is New Jersey, right?
Yes.
I'm trying to remember who they prioritized over, but was it teachers? I'm trying to remember.
Teachers are behind them.
Yeah, teachers are behind them. So what they're doing is they're following a complete medical criteria. You know, a debate in this country and the U.S., we had the debate with prisoners, right? Mm-hmm. Because prisoners, they're trapped in a congregate setting and a lot of them are older. So we had the debate in both countries about this. But look, what often happens with this is you try to be as value neutral as you possibly can. Any government, American, Canadian, or maybe not any government in the world, but certainly within Western democracies, you don't ever want to be in a position of saying this life is of higher value than that life. A lot of people have very little patience with smokers. They see it as highly self-destructive behavior. But again, look, it is considered an addiction. There's lots of smokers out there that wish they weren't smokers.
So would you be on board to do something like this in Canada too, with people who, because once a smoker gets it, whether or not you agree with them smoking, which is an addiction, as you point out, and a lot don't want to be smokers, but if these are people who are going to be in our community who can then spread COVID-19 more, wouldn't we want to have them vaccinated?
Yeah, you may, but look, we're nowhere near smokers or non-smokers in Canada. We can't even get vaccines to our most vulnerable people, which are the elderly and long-term care facilities. We're not even there yet. So, you know, and I would never look at a smoker independently of other medical factors. So, you know, a 20-year-old, and look, there's smokers out there that actually probably do not reach a threshold of addiction at all. They're young, they party, whatever's going on in their lives. They smoke in nightclubs, although I guess people don't go to nightclubs anymore. But, you know, that kind of
program. What's a nightclub?
But, you know, something that, because a lot of us smoked when we were younger and grew out of it. So I'm not saying everyone it's a lifelong addiction. But you know, smoking has to be looked at in a broader context. Smoking is pretty destructive. So often when you see smoking in people over the course of a lifetime, they've got other behaviors that are not so wonderful. And it doesn't sit well with exercise in a lot of cases as well. So I don't think smoking should be isolated as a single factor, but should be looked at with a lot of other things going on.
I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work, and we're having a conversation with Dr. Kerry Bowman. He's a professor of bioethics and global health at the University of Toronto. You know, when talking about the whole bioethics arguments, looking at different things, I know epidemiologists were looking at prisoners and saying why they needed, some who chose, you know, why prisoners do need to have vaccines, why they shouldn't, this, that, looking at all these different groups. What groups do you think, as a bioethicist, we need to have at that top tier first in line to get that vaccine?
Well, it is absolutely elderly people, particularly in a congregate setting. So that brings us to long-term care and to a second extent, I don't want to use the word lesser, retirement homes. And, you know, how are we doing on that front? Not very well. We're really not. It's a slow, slow rollout. And that's our tier one. You know, tier two is the second phase that's coming. We're not there yet. That's when we're going to get into these conversations about smokers or not smokers. And I don't think in Canada we would narrow it. Like, there's a lot more to a person's health status than whether they smoke or not. But you know, we're not doing well. I mean, the biggest bioethical dilemma we're facing right now is we're not getting it to people that are dying. And look, you know, there's a lot of prejudice in this. If those were children or if those were younger people, we'd move heaven and earth to do it. And, you know, I actually feel that having the rollout occurring through the hospitals, in my opinion, and I'm making lots of enemies on this, it wasn't a great idea to do it through the hospitals at all. They're often not that flexible. They can be quite bureaucratic, and they tend to write their own rules on these things. And now some hospitals are doing brilliant jobs, but I actually think it should really be a public health initiative. And we could say, well, we don't have the resources for that, then we should put the resources in there.
So if you rolled this out as a public health initiative, what would your structure be?
Well, it's not my struggle. You know, I would do what Canada's made some good decisions. I mean, we're going to go for the most vulnerable people. We've been very clear that is the real vulnerability is older people. The older they get, the higher the vulnerability. But also with particular health conditions, the Indigenous people of Canada, these are really good, solid decisions. In a lot of ways, we've made some great decisions. The challenge is now applying those decisions. That's very clear. The second one's going to be really tougher. You know, if you've got a bus driver on a busy route, would he or she get the vaccine before a person, you know, who's teaching, assuming that children come back to school? You know, like those sort of ones within the second tier. The third tier is likely going to be everybody else who's healthy and well. The second tier is actually going to be our bigger challenge, but we're not doing so well at the first. We've done well at deciding, and we have really broad national consensus. Most people absolutely want to see the most vulnerable people protected and are willing to wait, but it's been slow getting to them.
I have to go into work right now. I'm broadcasting from the studio here at 580 CFRA, for instance. And I know because I'm considered essential that when I looked at that COVID-19 vaccine chart you can go to online and it can help you determine when you would be in line to get a vaccination, that I would be in I'd be in one of the faster groups to get vaccinated, but I would want to give my spot to somebody else, because even though I'm going into work, I'm in a pretty safe situation and I'm pretty isolated and I don't have to deal with things. So the way that this is structured, it still doesn't feel to be quite right.
No, and it's tough. And look, in fairness, it's never going to be perfect. This is a really, really hard thing to do. I'd be happy, and I'm in a low, low, low priority. I'm too young. I'm not that young, but I'm absolutely too young for any kind of criteria. I don't have any health problems. I'd also be willing to give my spot if it was at all elevated to someone else. And you know, we should be able to do that. But, you know, I think we have to be very careful that if we're going to have these criteria, like people in long-term care and protecting those, we really have to stick to it. What's happened with the hospitals, some, is I get it. You know, people taking care of vulnerable people, there's no question they have to be protected. We need them. But when you start getting into administrative staff that are working from home and haven't set foot in a hospital for 6 months that are getting vaccinated, this is not right. This should not be happening, and it has been happening.
What a great question that I think that you brought up, but I'll also take credit for doing it with you, but I'll just say you inspired me. Should we be able to give up our spot in the COVID-19 vaccine line to someone else? That's a really good
question. Well, it'd be hard to administer, but yeah, because... But, you know, we're also hearing a lot of other people saying, I'm hearing people saying, yeah, you know what, I'm kind of glad I'm not at the top of the list. I want to see how this goes, right? So, and I think it'll go very well. And we're actually not seeing any side effects throughout the country. It's going very, very well in terms of people's tolerance. And remember, a lot of people being vaccinated are vulnerable, and they're tolerating it beautifully. So things are looking good on that front.
As a professor of bioethics, has there been a time in your career where this many people have shown as much interest in bioethics as they do now?
No, I've never been busier. No, it's really, really been huge because the pandemic has surfaced so many ethical questions. And, you know, when we get past this awful situation, it'll be a good thing because what we can do is we can look back on lessons learned and we can say, how do we rebuild our systems? How do we protect vulnerable people? How do we think about homelessness? Like it's exposed so many inequalities in society. And if we keep our minds open, you know, the rebuild after this is over, we can really improve society for a lot of people. And that's what I take from this pandemic is, you know, that's the good news.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time to join us today and for bringing a little bit of a smile. You need to Google our boss, Peter Angioni, and just take
I'll
your
have
hair.
A look.
Yeah, put it on his face. And then you guys need to do some sort of Instagram side by side. He loves Instagram. Dr. Carrie Bowman, professor of bioethics and global health at the University of Toronto and the first person to actually give me a great, genuine smile today. Sir, thank you so much for taking your time to join us.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend.
You too. I'm Dahlia. This is Ottawa at Work. And coming up next, what happens when COVID-19 never seems to go away? It is 11:18. It is 0 degrees. We're going towards one today. There is a snowfall warning in effect. Also, Justin Trudeau is expected to speak. We will take you to that live when that happens at about 11:30. I'm Dahlia, and this is 580 CFRA. Waste time with the masterpiece. This might be a better way to keep our community safe. We have been talking about this for a long time on the goods, and a report this week says sending civilians instead of police to mental health crises, homelessness issues, drug use calls could allow Toronto to cut its police budget by 25%. And Ottawa residents are also asking, well, why not here too? For some time, we've been talking about this long report, long before the report, for sure. And most notably, I've told you about an effort that was launched in 1989 by the White Bird Clinic in Eugene, Oregon. It's called CAHOOTS, and it's partially funded by the Eugene Police Department, which passes along calls about non-criminal and non-violent psychological crises. This is about 17% of the department's call volume. And so in 2019, for instance, CAHOOTS only requested police backup for 150 of 24,000 dispatches. That is a track record that has drawn renewed attention to the group's work. And the way that the world has been shifting this year, cities from around the world are starting to look at approaches like these. And this one is a model. It is an alternative to police that cops can support. How trained civilians, not sworn police officers, are responding to hundreds of 911 calls. So joining us now from the White Bird Clinic in Eugene, Oregon, the director of consulting, Tim Black. Good morning, Tim Black.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, this is, I imagine a lot of people would like to have some of your time right now to understand how something like this works. Have you been hearing from more and more people?
Yeah, since the momentum of this summer really kicked off, we've been in contact with over 500 communities throughout North America to really explore, you know, ins and outs of the CAHOOTS model and start those conversations around what it might mean to bring a similar model to their communities.
I wonder if even after what just happened in the Capitol, has that brought even more attention to you?
You know, the things that happened in the Capitol last week are certainly renewing some of the conversations around public safety for communities across the U.S., but we haven't seen a direct uptick from those events last week.
Well, let's get a little bit of a sense about CAHOOTS and how this all started. Take us back to that time.
Yeah, well, you know, to really talk about where CAHOOTS came from, we have to really just spend a minute understanding how White Bird Clinic was formed. In the late 60s, Eugene was seeing a lot of the same, you know, issues that other larger communities were, an influx of young folks, and with that increased mental health needs, increased addiction, and increased poverty and homelessness. And the founders of Wiper Clinic were really seeing that the systems in place at that time weren't adequate to respond to the level of need in our community, that we were seeing young people, going to the hospital and coming out in worse shape than they went in because of the medications and the treatment that they were receiving. There was concern even then about having unnecessary police interaction for, you know, issues related to addiction or mental health. And so our founders really tried to find a different way to approach these situations across the board. And as White Bird Clinic grew in its first 20 years, we had a lot of opportunity to really demonstrate to the community how we could have a role to play in crisis intervention, whether that was them calling us on our crisis line, walking into our clinic, or even with the predecessor of Cahoots, the Bummer Squad, where we were sending out volunteers using our own clinic resources to just try and meet people where they were at. Public safety in our community also really saw the trust that our citizens had in White Bird Clinic, and that was why we were approached to really start the Cahoots program. And so it was, 20 years of really just meeting people where they were at, being there for them on their worst days, that really allowed us to enter into the Cahoots service with our first shift on the 4th of July in 1989.
We have an organization here in Ottawa that is not as formally organized as yours, but it's Ottawa Street Medics. And they've told me something very similar, that they could approach somebody on the street to help them. And if at first somebody thinks that they're officers, they are not receptive to the help. But if they then realize that they're these street medics and people who are just, volunteering their services, trying to do good and make things better, help somebody in some of their toughest moments, they're much more receptive. And it's also creating a safer community in that sense. And so I imagine that aside from helping in the moments where you're actually making a difference, this proactive work that you're doing is also setting a tone that is making things a little bit better in the community. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, with my experience on the Cahoots program, and I've been with the program since 2010, we've seen that as the community really takes the time to understand what it is that Cahoots is trying to address in our community, we see that it becomes a lot easier to have those other conversations around what is it, what allowed the situation to unfold? Why is it that we have so many neighbors sleeping in tents, instead of inside four walls and a roof? And really, that's made all of those other conversations a lot easier. Why understanding the role that behavioral health first response can have in public safety. I'm really looking at how folks can talk to each other better. Whenever there's some sort of community education opportunity and Cahoots can come in, we take those opportunities to teach some of our de-escalation and communication skills, really kind of talk about empathy and compassion. And we see that as folks, go through those educational opportunities, they're going out and they're interacting with their community in a different way.
So if you're just joining, I'm Dahlia, this is The Goods, and we're having a conversation with Tim Black. He's from the White Bird Clinic in Eugene, Oregon, and we've been talking about Cahoots. This is like an alternative to police that is actually supported by police in Eugene, Oregon, because you're working as a team. I mean, you work on your own, but you're working as a team with the police.
Yeah, we rely a lot on our partnerships in public safety, and that's not just the police. That's the fire department, that's EMS, and that's even, other social service providers. Really, the success of the Cahoots program is based entirely on the trust that we see from our partners in law enforcement to be out there as civilian unarmed first responders in thousands of situations a year. The fire department knows that they can call on us for addiction issues when they encounter somebody who could really benefit from that Cahoots contact. We rely a lot on those partnerships, and we really celebrate that even when things got tough and tense, this summer, as protests in our community heated up, we were always able to maintain, a constructive relationship with our public safety partners.
What about people who will say, well, Eugene is a smaller area, so of course they can do something like that over there. How could this work in a big city like Toronto or Ottawa?
That's a really good question, and that's something that we're trying to tackle right now. You're absolutely right. Cahoots is operating in Eugene and Springfield, Oregon. It's a smaller community here. But as we have spent time really discussing this model with other communities, there's this really important recognition that every city, every community needs to have a role in designing what their mobile crisis program looks like. And to that extent, there's a lot of opportunity to work with, you know, consumer advisory boards, to work with the peers, the folks that are out there experiencing the impacts of the services as they exist right now, to shape something that can be successful in a larger community. You know, we supported the work in Denver, Colorado, that led up to the STAR program, which started running in June of 2020. We are right now helping train up responders in both Rochester, New York, and Portland, Oregon. And so I think that's going to be our first taste of what this program really looks like and really how it folds into those larger metropolitan systems. You know, alongside that, we're eager to have more conversation with the folks in Oakland and San Francisco as well, to really kind of continue to explore how this model fits into those larger city systems.
Portland, Oakland, San Francisco, these are some major cities with notorious instances that can be really changed by a program like Cahoots.
Absolutely.
This could be history making.
We're going to start with just reaching out to some folks first. Yeah.
Well, when we're looking at the things that you do, can you give us some scenarios, some cases that have taken place that can give us an idea? Okay, well, in this instance where we would typically send police, this was served much better by these people who don't have guns.
Yeah. So every time the Cahoots van is rolling around in service, it's going to be staffed by two folks. One of those an EMT, the other one a crisis worker. And that allows us to really respond to a wide variety of situations. Our staff work a 12-hour shift, and over the course of those 12 hours, it's very possible that you'll start off your day going to check in on somebody who's just trying to tuck in an alley, get out of the rain, and work with them to help get them into a better shelter setting. From there, it could be going to counsel somebody who's housed, who's fully employed and experiencing a real increase in their anxiety. Our teams respond to welfare checks. We facilitate a lot of intervention around suicidality. We do non-emergency medical care. So for that unhoused neighbor who's got that wound on their foot from walking around all day, rather than going in for an unnecessary emergency room visit, Cahoots teams can come out, do an assessment of that individual where they are, and either do some wound care right there on the street or help get them plugged into urgent care. Being a part of Whitebird Clinic also allows Cahoots to have access to, you know, a really wonderful medical and dental clinic, case management, and all sorts of peer support and outpatient behavioral health services. So really, you know, over the course of that shift, you know, it's likely that our Cahoots teams are going to be responding to all sorts of different crises, whether it's something related to mental health, poverty, you know, addiction or housing. We respond to calls with law enforcement. We take over situations from law enforcement or from paramedics on a regular basis. So really, you know, anybody that's out there that's in any sort of crisis, you know, is likely going to benefit from a Cahoots interaction.
Has there ever been an interaction where Cahoots has been on its own and it's just been too dangerous?
You know, there are situations every once in a while, and you mentioned that, you know, right at the start of this call, is that there are occasionally situations where things are just too escalated. There's too much aggression. There's too much violence going on. There's some sort of other factors that lead to this being an unsafe situation. And both because of our training as Cahoots responders and the fact that we're plugged into the larger public safety system, you know, we wear a police radio right on our shoulder. And that means that when things do get heated, when we do need that support from law enforcement, you know, we're able to call on them just like another officer might be calling in for additional resources. And so that's really allowed us to maintain a safety record where we've never had a patient or a staff member injured during an interaction.
The world has changed so much over the past 30 years. How have you had to change over the past 30 years, and how do you want to change now?
Yeah, you know, I think we've had to become a lot more resilient, you know, as first responders. The work demand has increased exponentially just in the 10 years that I've been with the program. And so, you know, we see both a higher acuity in a lot of the situations we're encountering and just a lot more frequency. And so our program has really had to work to support our staff resiliency, but also make sure that we have adequate resources to respond to the level of need that's going on out there in our community. We are certainly, you know, administering Narcan for opioid overdose a lot more often than we used to. And with this pandemic, you know, folks are isolated, you know, and with everything that's going on in the U.S. Capitol, there's a lot of fear and trepidation out there. So You know, our teams are just responding to situations that are a lot harder than they might have been, you know, a couple years ago, for no other reason than just, you know, the global circumstance.
When you're approached by other places who show interest in Kahoot's model and how you're operating, what does there seem to be a common question, a common need from each of these cities or organizations who approach Kahoot's, Tim?
Yeah, I think the biggest need that we see is for there to be a real, I think, understanding of what all of the services are in the community. You know, you mentioned that, you know, you have your street medics. How often are those street medics being utilized by other resources? You know, what's the landscape? The CAHOOTS program is able to achieve a real high rate of diversion from the criminal legal system and keeping folks out of the hospital because we have all of these other resources that we can turn towards. After we de-escalate that situation for somebody, we can get them connected to another service. And so as communities are exploring the idea of bringing something similar to CAHOOTS in, we really need to start by looking at what is there in your community, what's out there for us to, you know, get folks plugged into. Where can we take somebody so that they don't have to spend that night in jail, so that they don't need to go to the emergency room for a non-emergent issue?
What's the biggest lesson that you've learned from CAHOOTS?
I think the biggest lesson that I've learned personally, both as a first responder and now in this work doing outreach with other communities, is that we need to let go of our expectations. We need to let go of that attachment to outcomes. When it comes to, you know, the interactions with patients, I'm not the expert in the lived experience, right? You know, the person that I'm talking to lives their life day in and day out. And when I get attached to an outcome, I disregard that person's experience. I disregard their voice. When it comes to our work with other communities, we need to slow down and say, yes, we want to achieve that goal of having this CAHOOTS style response in your community. But we got to do it right. You know, we got to get buy-in from all the different players involved. We got to make sure your community knows how to use this system. So once you hit the ground running, you know, you're going to be successful.
I think that what you have done with CAHOOTS, what your organization has done, how this started, wow, like 30 years ago, it's just been right there in front of our eyes this whole time. And you've been showing how well it's been serving your community. And I would love to check in and find out how things are going when you look at this more with Portland and Oakland and San Francisco and those small projects with them, because you could be saving so many lives, and not just saving lives, but just making communities generally better and safer places. So thank you for all of the work that you do.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Tim, if people want to learn more about CAHOOTS, where can they find more information?
Yeah, easiest way to learn more about CAHOOTS and White Bird Clinic is to go to our website, and that's whitebirdclinic.org.
Tim Black is the Director of Consulting at White Bird Clinic in Eugene, Oregon. We are going to be following up with you definitely in the near future. Thanks for taking your time to join us today.
This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Happy Friday to you. I'm Dahlia. It's 11:23, 0 degrees, going up to 1. And still ahead, we are expecting Justin Trudeau. He's supposed to speak around 11:30. That doesn't necessarily mean he will speak at 11:30. But once he does, we will take you to that live. He's expected to talk about the new COVID-19 model, and that trajectory does not look good. Also, we're going to hopefully be able to get to something that could help change your workplace. That is coming up. But first, scientists have learned a lot about COVID-19 in record time, right? But there are still a lot of uncertainties about coronavirus and the disease it causes. And one of those mysteries is long-haul COVID. People who get COVID-19, they recover, but then they experience these lingering symptoms for months. So joining us now, we have a cardiologist and medical writer with a degree in epidemiology, must have had a very fun social life during those university years, Dr. Christopher Labus. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, and let me assure you, I had virtually no social life during all of my 20s.
Did you ever get to make up for it?
No. Well, no, probably not. Probably not.
And now you have no time with all of your radio interviews, especially with COVID-19. Well, looking at this right now, looking at these long haulers, for me, I would imagine if I were one of them, what would make me most afraid or uncomfortable is just the unknown. When will this get better? When will this go away? Am I stuck with this forever?
Yeah, no, and that's a really good question. And the answer is we don't really know, because our experience with the virus is still somewhat limited. Most people who have gotten sick don't have any long-term follow-up yet. So we know what happens at about 6 months, but we don't know what happens at a year or 2 years. It's possible that some of these symptoms will go away on their own or not, and we really don't know. And the other big problem is that when we're talking about these problems, we're probably not talking about just one thing, right? For some people, it's because the virus left scar tissue in their lungs. For some people, it's because they were probably left with inflammation around their heart. For some people, just the consequence of deconditioning, of having been in hospital for, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so. So it becomes even more complicated in that you're probably talking about a very large grab bag of problems, some of which may get better and some of which may not.
Another one that I haven't heard people discuss often, but I've looked up some medical science journals and I've seen that there is a question of fertility, especially in men after COVID-19. What have you heard about this?
So I haven't heard that much, to be honest with you. Again, because we haven't lived with this virus for that long, it's hard to know if that's real or not. And fertility is a tricky thing because there's a lot of things that you can measure with respect to fertility. You can measure sperm count, you can measure sperm quality, you can do all kinds of tests for men, but they don't necessarily correlate with your ability to father a child. Like your sperm count can be very high, and you're not able to father a child. And the flip side of that is you can have a very low sperm count and still have a child. So it's very hard to be absolutely certain about this. So you're going to hear a lot of stuff. You're going to hear a lot of speculation. We have to remember that, at least for now, it still is speculation to a large degree. A lot of this will be clarified with time. And remember that even though it seems like forever, most people have not, we don't have very much long-term follow-up. Like this new study that came out in The Lancet had to go back to look at the patient records of people in China, like some of the first people who ever got sick. We still don't know very much with North American or European data, because we just don't have enough patients that have been followed for long enough to draw any firm conclusions.
The other question about COVID-19, and I guess you could say the aftermath or long haulers, is the psychological impact and how they found that more people were diagnosed with a psychological ailment after COVID-19. How much of this can we even say is attributed to, you know, what's going on in the world today and how it's impacting our psychological health versus how much of this is a physical or biochemical change in your body because of the COVID-19 virus?
Well, it could be a combination of the two. Listen, just being in hospital is traumatic psychologically for people, especially for older people, especially if you're in the ICU. Like there is an impact that has on you. So and this is true of any illness, not just of COVID-19. So just the physical burden that has been placed on society from this illness, the fact that people have to stay home, yeah, it's taking a toll on people. It's unfortunately, to a very large degree, necessary. But look, there's a lot of ancillary problems that have come from COVID-19 beyond the infection, right? People are staying home. It's harder for people to access medical care. There's been a lot of delays in treating people with heart disease and cancer and all the regular stuff that we treat because, you know, our hospital system is being stretched to the breaking point. So there's so many downstream consequences to this. I don't think we're really going to know the true cost of this pandemic for years to come. But, I mean, the best we can do is handle the current crisis, get everyone vaccinated, get over this, and then we'll pick up the pieces of all the other stuff and hopefully we'll get stuff back on track slowly.
Well, Dr. Christopher Labos, thank you for joining us today. And I hope that if anything, more than being a cardiologist and medical writer and your understanding of epidemiology, I hope that university and your lack of social life there prepared you for the absolute nil social life that you will have right now during the pandemic.
I am used to it. That's true.
Well, congratulations on that. You have a degree in no social life as well. Dr. Christopher Labos, have yourself a very unsocial but still nice weekend.
Thank you very much. You too. Take care.
Abdalia, this is Ottawa at Work. We are waiting for an update from the Prime Minister on COVID-19 response. Modeling shows nearly 800,000 cases are possible by January 24th. That's coming up ahead. And maybe a way to make your workplace better. We're going to get to that as well. It's 11:30. Your news is next. 0 degrees in Ottawa.